In bed, in peacock pajamas, scalded and renewed from the hot spray, she asks, "How's the reading?" He needs a moment to remember what he spent all night trying to read. "What is needed is a myth." "Difficult. I wasn't all there."
"Hmm."
She rolls on her side to face him, eyes closed.
"Tell me."
"I do not think it too remote that we may come to regard the earth, as some have suggested, as one organism, of which mankind is a functional part. The mind, perhaps." "He wants to give rights to everything alive. He claims that paying trees for their creative invention would make the whole world richer. If he's right, then our entire social system, everything I've ever worked for." But her breathing has changed, and she floats away like a newborn after a day of first discoveries. He douses the bedside light and turns away from her. Still, she murmurs in her sleep and grapples to him, clutching his backside for whatever warmth he generates, her bare arms on him, the woman he fell in love with, the woman he married. Funny, manic, wild, untamable Lady Macbeth, lover of sprawling novels, jumper from airplanes, the best amateur actress he has ever known. Watchman and Maidenhair, deep in the redwoods. He lugs a pack of provisions. She holds the camp's video camera in one hand. With her other, she clutches his arm like a channel swimmer hanging from a dinghy. Now and then, she grabs his wrist, directing his attention to something colorful or darting just outside their comprehension. Last night, they slept on the cold ground, open to the air. Seas of mud moated their fern-fringed island. He lay in one pea-stained 1950s sleeping bag, and she in another, underneath creatures of mildness, bulk, and repose. "Aren't you freezing?" he asked. She answered no, and he believed her. "Sore?"
"Not really."
"Scared?" Her eyes said, "Why?" Her mouth said, "Should we be?" "They're so big. Humboldt Timber employs hundreds of people, thousands of machines. It's owned by a multi-billion-dollar multinational. All the laws are on their side, backed by the will of the American people. We're a bunch of unemployed vandals camping out in the woods." She smiled, as at a little kid who just asked whether the Chinese could reach them through a tunnel in the earth. Her hand snaked out of her bag and into his.
"Believe me, I have it on the highest authority. Great things are underway."
Her hand stayed between them, like a traverse line, as she fell asleep. They follow a switchback down into a distant drainage until the path turns into a rivulet of mud. 2 miles in, the trail vanishes, and the two of them must bushwhack. Light sifts through the canopy. He watches her cross a carpet of starflower massed with sorrel. Mere months ago, by her own account, she was a nasty, jaded, narcissistic bitch with a substance abuse problem, flunking out of college. Now she's... what? Something at peace with being human, in league with something very much not. The redwoods do strange things. They hum. They radiate arcs of force. Their burls spill out in enchanted shapes. She grabs his shoulder.
"Look at that!"
12 apostle trees stand in a fairy ring as perfect as the circles little Nicky once drew with a protractor on rainy Sundays decades ago. Centuries after their ancestors' death, 12 basal clones surround the empty center, all around the compass rose. A chemical semaphore passes through Nick's brain. Suppose a person had sculpted any one of these just as they stand. That single work would be a landmark of human art. Alongside the Pebbly Creek, they come to a downed giant that even sideways is taller than Olivia.
"We are here. Just to the right," Mother N said. "This way."
He sees it first, a grove of trunks 600 years old, running upward out of sight. The pillars of a russet cathedral nave, trees older than movable type. But their furrows are spray-painted with white numbers, like someone tattooed a living cow with a butcher diagram showing the various cuts of meat hidden underneath. Orders for a massacre. Olivia lifts the handycam to her face and films. Nick slips off his backpack, floats weightless for a few steps. A rainbow of spray cans comes from his pack. He lays them in a patch of young horsetails. Half a dozen colors from across the spectrum. Cherry in one hand, lemon in the other. He wanders toward a marked tree. He studies the white strokes already there. Then he lifts the can and sprays. Later, her video will be edited, fitted out with voiceover, and sent to every sympathetic journalist in the Life Defense Force address book. For now, the soundtrack is the 100 cries of the forest, punctuated by awe.
"How do you do that?"
up close to the microphone. Nick returns to his palette on the forest floor and picks two more hues. He paints, then steps back to appraise his handiwork. The species are as wild as any that inhabit a museum's collection cabinet. He goes on to the next numeral-defaced tree and starts again. Soon enough, the numbers disappear past recognition into butterflies. He graduates to those trunks marked by a simple blue tick. They're everywhere, these death sentences made with a simple stroke. Then he proceeds to paint those trees with no markings at all, until it's impossible to say which trunks have been slated for cutting and which are mere bystanders. The afternoon vanishes. They've both been on forest time too long to count in mere hours anymore. The work is over in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Olivia pans the camera around the transformed grove. Where there had been measurements and prospects, a project of hard numbers, there are now only skippers and swallowtails, morphos, hair streaks, and heaths. It could be a grove of sacred firs in the Mexican mountains, where Tiffany insects stage their many-generation migration. Thus, two people in an afternoon undo a week's work of appraisers and surveyors. The voice on the unedited video says, "They'll be back." He means the numbers men, to mark their culls again in a more foolproof way.
"But this is beautiful. It'll cost them."
Maybe. Or the lumber shows will just come in and take everything, like they did at Merlet Grove.
"We have film now."
You can hear it in the music of her recorded voice, the belief that affection might solve the problems of freedom yet. Then the film cuts to black. No one sees what happens next between the two humans, there on the forest floor, between the banks of fern and Solomon's seal. No one, unless you count the countless invisible creatures burrowing beneath the soil, crawling under the bark, crouching in the branches, climbing and leaping and banking through the canopy. Even the giant trees breathe in the few molecules per billion of homecoming dispensed into the air. Patricia hears from a quarter mile away, Dennis's truck thumping down the gravel washboard road. The sound gladdens her, glad before she knows she's glad. In its way, the crunch and whir lift her as much as the wheezy cheep of a Townsend's warbler skirting the edge of a clearing. The truck is its own wildlife rarity, although this creature appears every day as punctual as the rain. She drifts down to the road, feeling how edgy her weight has been these last 20 minutes. He'll have lunch, yes, and the mail, her mixed bag of connections with the outside world, new data from the lab in Corvallis. But Dennis, that's the installment her soul now needs. He steadies her, his listening, and she wonders with delighted horror whether 22 hours might be too long to go between sightings. She comes up close to the halted truck and must step back when he opens the cab. His broad arm swings around her waist, and he nuzzles her neck.
Den, my favorite mammal.
Babe, wait till you see what we're having.
He hands her the mail and grabs the cooler. They climb the slope to the cabin, shoulder to shoulder, at peace with each other in silence. She sits on the porch at the cable spool table, thumbing through the mail as he unpacks lunch. How can the masterful duplicity, important information about your insurance, open at once, find her even here? She has lived far from commerce for decades, and yet her name is a hot commodity, bought and sold endlessly as she sits in her cabin reading Thoreau. She hopes the buyers aren't paying much. No, she hopes they're being extorted. Nothing from Corvallis, but there's a packet from her agent. She sets it down on the wooden slats next to her plate. It's still there when Dennis brings out 2 small, magnificent, stuffed rainbow trout.
Everything okay?
She nods and shakes her head all at once.
No bad news, is there?
No. I don't know. I can't open it.
He doles out the fish and picks up the packet.
It's from Jackie. What's to be afraid of?
She doesn't know. Lawsuits, chastisements, official business. Open at once. He hands her the envelope and flicks the air, nudging her courage.
You're good for me, Dennis.
She slips her finger under the sealed lip, and many things spill out. Reviews, forwarded fan mail. A letter from Jackie with a check paperclip to it. She sees the check and yelps. The paper falls to the ground and lands face down in the always damp earth. Dennis retrieves the check and wipes it clean. He whistles.
Jeepers!
He looks at her, eyebrows high.
Misplaced a decimal point there, did they?
2 places!
He laughs, his shoulders shuddering, like his antique truck trying to turn over after a night below freezing.
She told you the book was doing well.
There's a mistake. We have to pay it back.
You made a good thing, Patty. People like good things.
It isn't possible.
Don't get excited. It's not that much.
But it is. It's more than she has ever had in any bank her whole life.
The money's not mine.
What do you mean it's not yours? You worked on that book for 7 years.
She doesn't hear him. She's listening to the wind coming through the alders.
You can always give it away. Write a check to American Forests. Or maybe to that Chestnut Backcross Recovery Program. You could invest it in the research team. Come on, eat your fish now. Took me 2 hours to catch these guys.
After lunch, he reads her the reviews. Somehow, in Dennis's radio baritone, they sound mostly good. Appreciative. People say, I didn't realize. People say, I've started seeing things. Then he reads her the reader's letters. Some of them just want to thank her. Some of them confuse her with the mother of all trees. Some of them make her feel like Miss Lonely Hearts.
I have a big bur oak in our backyard that must be 200 years old. Last spring, one side of it started to sicken. It's killing me to watch it die in slow motion. What can I do?
Many mention the giving trees.
Those ancient Douglas firs that, with their last act, give all their secondary metabolites back to the community.
Hear that, babe? You've made me think about life in a different way. That might be a compliment.
She laughs, but it sounds like a bobcat caught in a snare.
Oh, now here's something. A request to go on the most listened-to public radio program in the country. They're doing a series on the planet's future, and they need someone to speak for the trees.
She hears his words from high up in a Douglas fir in the middle of a howling storm. Human industry everywhere. People need things from her. People mistake her for someone else. People mean to drag her violently back into what people mistakenly call the world. Moses comes into base camp frazzled. Actions everywhere, and they've lost 13 people to detention and arrest in the last half week.
We've got a legacy tree sit that needs manning. Anyone up for a brief stint up top?
Maidenhair's hand shoots into the air before Watchman even understands the request. Such a look crosses her face.
Yes, this, at last.
You sure? Moses asks,
as if he hasn't just fulfilled the Voices of Light's predictions.
You'll be up there for at least a few days.
She assures Nick while she packs,
If you think you can do more from down here, I'll be fine by myself. They wouldn't dare hurt me. Think of the press.
He won't be fine, except where she is. It's that simple, that absurd. He doesn't tell her. The thing is so screamingly obvious, even in the way he hovers and nods. Of course she knows. She can hear beings that aren't even here. Of course she can hear his banging thoughts, the blood pounding in his ears, even above the endless rain. Their packs go up and over the gate first. Then they follow. Maidenhair, Watchman, and their guide, Loki, who has run ground support for this tree for weeks. Their feet come back down in humble timber territory, trespass with criminal intent. The packs are heavy and the path steep. Weeks of steady rain have turned the trail to Turkish coffee. Weeks ago, they wouldn't have made it to mile 3. Even now, 5 miles in, Watchman sucks air in great gulps. He's ashamed and falls back on the trail, where she can't hear him wheeze. The path ascends a sloppy escarpment. The weight of the pack and the foot-sucking muck pull him down until every step is a pole vault. He stops to catch his breath, and the sleety air goes through him. Up ahead, Maidenhair forges on like some mythic beast. Power rises into her feet from the needle-bedded ground. Each mud-coated plunge renews her. She's dancing. Cowardice adds several stones to Nick's pack. He doesn't want to get arrested. He's not crazy about heights. He has only love to drive him up the cliff face. She's fueled by the need to save everything alive. Loki puts out his palm. See that flashing light? Buzzard and sparks. They hear us. He cups his hand to his lips and hoots. The light up in the high forest flashes again, impatient. This, too, makes Loki laugh. Those bastards can't wait to get back down to Earth. Can you tell? Nick is ready himself, and he hasn't even left the ground. They slog the last few hundred yards up the rut. A profile emerges out of the thicket. So huge, it can't be right. There it is, Loki says pointlessly. There's Mimas. Sounds come up and out of Nick's mouth, syllables that mean, loosely, oh my hopeless Jesus. He has seen monster trees for weeks, but never one like this. Mimas, wider across than his great-great-great-grandfather's old farmhouse. Here, as sundown blankets them, the feel is primeval, darshan, a face-to-face intro to divinity. The tree runs straight up like a chimney butte and neglects to stop. From underneath, it could be Yggdrasil, the world tree, with its roots in the underworld and crown in the world above. 25 feet above ground, a secondary trunk springs out of the expanse of flank, a branch bigger than the whole chestnut. 2 more trunks flare out higher up the main shaft. The whole ensemble looks like some exercise in cladistics, the evolutionary tree of life. 1 great idea splintering into whole new family branches, high up in the run of long time. Watchman humps up to where Maidenhair stands, gazing, wondering if it's too late to back out. But even in the falling light, her face glows with cause. All the agitation that has been such a part of her since she pulled into his gravel driveway back in Iowa has drained away, replaced by a certainty as pure and painful as that solitary calling owl's. She spreads her arms against the furrows. She's like a flea trying to hug its dog. Her face tilts straight up the titanic trunk.
I can't believe it. I can't believe there's no other way to protect this thing except with our bodies.
Loki says, if nobody's losing money or getting hurt, the law doesn't give a fuck.
The base of the tree, between 2 enormous burls, opens onto a charcoal-lined goose pen large enough to sleep all 3 of them tonight. Black soot marks run up the trunk, the scars of fires that burned long before there was an America. A tear in the lower crown recalls a lightning strike still fresh enough to ooze. And from high up in the tangled mass, vanishingly far above ground, come the cheers of 2 exhausted people out of their element who just want to be dry and warm and safe again tonight for a few hours. Something tumbles down from above. Watchman shouts and pulls Maidenhair aside. The snake flops down to the forest floor. A rope dangles in the air, the width of Watchman's index finger, in front of a shaft wider than his field of view.
What do we do with this? Attach the packs?
Loki chuckles.
You climb it.
He produces a harness, loops of knotted rope, and carabiners. He starts to put the belt of the harness around Watchman's waist.
Hang on. What's this? Are these staples?
There has been some wear. Don't worry. The staples and duct tape won't be bearing your weight.
No, this little shoestring here will be bearing my weight.
It has carried loads a lot heavier than you.
Olivia steps between the bickering men and takes the harness. She pulls it around her own waist. Loki clamps her in with carabiners. He cables her to the climbing rope with 2 sliding prussic knots, one for her chest and the other for a foot stirrup.
See? Your weight pulls these knots tight to the rope, like little fists. But when you release,
he slips one of the slack knots up the rope.
Stand up on the stirrup. Push the chest knot as high as you can. Lean back and let it take the weight. Sit back into the harness. Slip the stirrup knot as high as it will go. Then stand up on that. Repeat.
Maidenhair laughs. Like an inchworm?
Exactly like.
She inches. She stands up. She leans back and sits. She stands and inches again, climbing a ladder of air, hoisting herself in self-raising footholds up off the face of the earth. Watchman stands underneath as she scoots up, seat of the pants, into the sky. The intimacy, her body writhing above him, makes his soul flush.
She's the squirrel Ratatoskr, scaling Yggdrasil, carrying messages between hell, heaven, and here.
She's a natural, Loki says. She's flying. She'll reach the top in 20 minutes.
She does, though every muscle in her is shaking by arrival. From above, cheers greet her summit. Down at ground level, jealousy seizes Nick, and when the harness drops again, he springs into it. He gets about 100 feet into the air before freaking. The rope can't possibly hold him. It's twisting and making weird nylon groans. He cranes his neck to see how much farther. Forever. Then he makes the mistake of looking down. Loki twirls in slow circles below. His face points upward like a tiny Pacific star flower about to be crushed underfoot. Watchman's muscles surrender to panic. He closes his eyes and whispers, "I can't do this. I'm dead." He feels the zoom, the endless drop coursing through his legs. 2 small lumps of vomit come up his throat and onto his windbreaker. But Olivia is talking up close into his ear.
"Nick, you've done this already. I've seen it for weeks. A hand," she says. "A foot. Sit. Slide the knot. Stand."
He opens his eyes on the trunk of Mimas, the largest, strongest, widest, oldest, surest, sanest living thing he has ever seen. Keeper of 500,000 days and nights, and it wants him in its crown. Shouts greet him at the top. Those above him fasten him with 2 clamps into the tree. Olivia scampers about the platforms connected by rope ladder. Buzzard and Sparks have long since talked her through every clause in the lease. They want only to be down before night traps them. They climb down the rope to Loki, who calls up through the encroaching dark, "Someone will be by with your replacements in a few days. All you need to do until then is stay aloft." Then, Nick is alone with this woman who has commandeered his life. She takes his hand, which still has not unkinked from gripping.
"Nick, we're here, in Mimas."
She speaks the creature's name like it's an old friend, like she's been talking with it for a long time. They sit next to each other in needle-grazed darkness, 200 feet in the air, on what Buzzard and Sparks called the Grand Ballroom, a 7-by-9-foot platform made of 3 doors bolted together. Sliding tarp walls shelter them on 3 sides.
"Bigger than my room at college," Olivia says, "and nicer."
Balanced on another branch just beneath, reachable by rope ladder, is a smaller piece of plywood, a rain barrel, collecting jar, and sealable bucket complete the bathroom. 6 feet above them, on a higher spur, another platform serves as pantry, kitchen, and den. It's filled with water, food, tarps, and supplies. A hammock stretched between 2 limbs cradles a substantial lending library left here by previous sitters. The whole 3-level treehouse balances on top of an enormous fork made when the trunk was hit by lightning centuries ago. It sways with every breeze. A kerosene lamp illuminates her face. He has never seen her look so confirmed.
"Come here."
She takes his wrist and guides it to her.
"Here. Closer."
As if farther away were an option. And she takes him like someone who's sure that life has need of her. In the night, something soft and warm grazes his face. It's her hand, he thinks, or the fall of her hair as she leans over him. Even the slow, seasick barcarolle of the sleeping bag bed feels blessed. The cramped quarters of love. A claw cuts into his cheek, and the succubus lets loose with falsetto gibbers. Watchman bolts up, screaming, "Shit!" He pitches toward the platform ledge, but his safety cable catches him.
one palm punches through the fantasy of tarp walls. Lives go shrieking off into the branches.
She's up in a flash, pinning his arms.
Nick, stop. Nick!
It's okay.
Danger breaks up into little pieces. In the hail of chatter, he's slow to hear what she keeps saying.
Flying squirrels. They've been playing all over us for 10 minutes.
Jesus! Why?
She laughs and pets him and pulls him back down horizontal. You'll just have to ask them if they ever come back. She nuzzles him, her belly in the small of his back. Sleep won't come. There are creatures that live so high up and far away from man that they never learned fear. And thanks to the insanity in his cells, Nick has, this very first night on his very first tree sit, taught them. Light gathers in speckled fistfuls on his face. He has slept almost not at all, but rises refreshed, in a way normally reserved for the industrious. He rolls onto his side and lifts the tarp. The whole spectrum streams in, from blues to browns, greens to absurd golds.
Look at that!
Lucy,
her voice, sleepy but eager, breathes in his ear.
Oh, goodness!
They look together, high-wire surveyors of a newfound land. The view cracks open his chest. Cloud, mountain, world tree, and mist. All the tangled, rich stability of creation that gave rise to words to begin with leave him stupid and speechless. Reiterated trunks grow out of Mimas's main line, shooting up parallel like the fingers of a Buddha's upraised hand, recouping the mother tree on smaller scales, repeating the inborn shape again and again, their branches running into each other, too mazy and fused to trace. Fog coats the canopy. Through an opening in Mimas's crown, the tufted spires of nearby trunks stand swirled in the gauze of a Chinese landscape. There's more substance to the grayish puffs than there is to the green-brown spikes poking through them. All around them spreads a phantasmagoric Ordovician fairy tale. It's morning, like the morning when life first came up on dry land. Watchman sweeps back another wall of tarp along its rope runner and looks up. Dozens more feet of Mimas unfold above. Trunks that took over when lightning clipped this one. The top of the tangled system disappears into low cloud. Fungi and lichen everywhere, like splatters of paint from a heavenly can. He and Maidenhair perch most of the way up the Flatiron building. He looks down. The floor of the forest is a dollscape a little girl might make out of acorns and ferns. His legs go cold with thoughts of plummeting. He lowers the tarp. She's staring at him, madness in her hazel eyes that spills out as cackling.
We're here. We made it. This is where they want us.
She looks like someone summoned to help the most wondrous products of 4 billion years of life. Here and there, solo spires rise above the giant's chorus. They look like green thunderheads or rocket plumes. From below, the tallest neighbors read like mid-sized incense cedars. Only now, 70 yards above the ground, can Nicholas gauge the true size of these few old ones, 5 times larger than the largest whale. Giants march down into the ravine the 3 of them climbed last night. In the middle distance, the forest broadens into denser, deeper blue. He has read about these trees and their fog. On every side, trees lap at the low, wet sky, the clouds they themselves have helped to seed. Skeins of aerial needles, knobbier and more gnarled, a different thing from the smooth shoots growing at ground level, sip the fog banks, condensing water vapor
and sieving it down the sluices of twigs and branches.
Nick glances upstairs into the kitchen, where their own water catchment system works away, running droplets into a bottle.
What struck him as ingenious last night, water for nothing, turns crude compared to the tree's invention.
Nicholas watches the drama as if thumbing an infinite flipbook.
The land unfolds, ridge beyond ridge. His eyes adjust to the baroque abundance. Forests of five different shades bathe in the mist, each one a biome to creatures still to be discovered. And every tree he looks on belongs to a Texas financier who has never seen a redwood, but means to gut them all to pay off the debt he took on to acquire them.
A shift in the warmth next to him reminds Watchman. He's not the only large vertebrate in this roost.
If I don't quit looking, my bladder's going to burst.
He watches Olivia scramble down the rope ladder to the platform below. He thinks, I really should look away. But he's living in a tree 200 feet above the surface of the planet. Flying squirrels have surveilled his face. Fogs from the world's infancy turn the clock back eons, and he feels himself becoming another species.
She squats above the wide-mouthed jar, and a stream rushes out of her.
He has never seen a woman urinate, something a fair number of all the human males who've ever lived might have to say on their deathbeds. The ritual concealment suddenly seems like some strange animal behavior that might turn up on a BBC wildlife documentary, like fish that change sex when they need to, or spiders that consume their partners after mating.
He hears that revered, received pronunciation whispering off camera.
When removed from their kind, individual human beings can change in remarkable ways.
She knows he's watching. He knows she knows. Here, raw, now. The culture suited to this place.
When she's done, she tips the jar over the side of the platform. The wind takes the liquid and disperses it. 20 feet, and her waist atomizes into the fog.
Needles will rework it into something alive again.
My turn, he says when she comes back. And then, from above, she watches him crouch into the bag-lined bucket, which will go to Loki for removal and compost when he shows up next. They take breakfast al fresco. Their chill fingers feed hazelnuts and dried apricots into mouths that hang open, awed by the view. Sitting still and looking, their new job description. But they're humans, and soon enough their eyes fill up.
She says, "Let's explore."
The main trails from the grand ballroom are laid out with loops and lobster claws, rope ladders, places to hook a carabiner to. She gives him the harness. Then she makes one for herself from 3 nylon climbing cables.
Barefoot, you'll stick better.
He wobbles out on a waving branch. The wind blows and Mimas's entire crown dips and bucks. He'll die. Plunge 20 stories onto a bed of ferns. But he's getting used to the idea. And there are worse ways to go.
They head off in different directions. No point in trying to spot each other. He inches along one barrel-sized limb, cabled in, scooting on his pants seat.
The scraped branch smells of lemons. A twig, growing out of it, holds a shock of cones, each one smaller than a marble. He takes one and taps it on his open palm. Seeds fall out, like coarsely ground pepper. One sticks in the crease of his lifeline. From such a speck came a tree that holds him 200 feet in the air without flexing. This fortress tower that could sleep a village and still have room to let. From high above, she calls, "Huckleberries! A whole patch up here!"
Bugs swarm, iridescent, party-colored, minuscule horror film monsters. He works his way to a strange junction, careful never to look down. Two large beams, over the course of centuries, have flowed together like modeling clay. He grapples to the top of the hillock and finds it hollow. Inside is a small lake. Plants grow along a pond flecked with tiny crustaceans. Something moves in the shallows, speckled all over in chestnut, bronze, black, and yellow. Seconds pass before Nick coughs up a name. Salamander. How did a damp-seeking creature with inch-long limbs climb two-thirds of the length of a football field up the side of dry, fibrous bark? Maybe a bird dropped it here, fumbling a meal into the canopy. Unlikely. The chest of the slick creature rises and falls. The only plausible explanation is that his ancestors got on board 1,000 years ago and rode the elevator up for 500 generations. Nick edges himself back the way he came. He's propped up in the corner of the grand ballroom when Maidenhair returns. She's ditched the safety umbilical.
You'll never believe what I found. A 6-foot hemlock growing in a mat of soil this deep.
Jesus Christ. Olivia, were you free climbing?
Don't worry. I climbed a lot of trees when I was little.
She kisses him, a quick preemptive strike.
And, you know, Mimas says he won't let us fall.
He sketches her as she copies her morning discoveries into a spiral notebook. The drill of solitude comes so much easier to him than to her. After years of camping in an Iowa farmhouse, a day at the top of this Leviathan flagpole is like stepping out. She, though, in her core chemistry, is still a college girl, addicted to a rate of stimulations per second that she hasn't entirely kicked. The fog burns off. Deep in the expanse of midday, she asks,
"What time would you say it is?"
Her question is more mystified than agitated. The sun hasn't passed overhead, and yet the two of them are so much older than they were this time yesterday. He looks up from sketching the local labyrinth of Mimas's limbs and shakes his head. She giggles.
Okay. What day?
Yet soon enough, an afternoon, half an hour, a minute, half a sentence, or half a word, all feel the same size. They disappear into the rhythm of no rhythm at all. Just crossing the 9-foot platform is a national epic. More time passes. A tenth of an eternity. 2/10. When she speaks again, the softness shatters him.
I never knew how strong a drug other people are.
The strongest. Or at least, the most widely abused.
How long does it take to detox?
He considers. Nobody's ever clean. He sketches her as she makes lunch, as she naps, coaxing birds or playing with a mouse at 200 feet. Her struggle to slow down looks to him like the human saga in a nutshell, in a redwood seed. He sketches the ravine full of redwoods, and the scattered giants that tower over their lesser brothers. Then he puts the drawing pad aside, the better to see the changing light. You hear them? He asks. A distant buzzing, systematic and competent. Saws and engines.
Yes, they're everywhere.
Every falling giant brings the crews closer. Trees 10 feet thick and 900 years old go down in 20 minutes and are bucked within another hour. When a large one falls, even from a distance, it's like an artillery shell hitting a cathedral. The ground liquefies. Their platform 200 feet up in Mimas shivers. The largest trees the world has ever made, saved for this final roundup. In the hammock library, she finds a book, The Secret Forest. The front cover shows a prehistoric U, above ground and below. The back proclaims, "The year's surprise bestseller, translated into 23 languages."
Would you like me to read to you a little?
She reads like she's in the front of the assembled class, reciting that long freight train of stanzas from Leaves of Grass that the entire 10th grade was assigned to memorize.
You and the tree in your backyard come from a common ancestor.
She stops and looks out the transparent wall of their treehouse. 1.5 billion
years ago, the two of you parted ways.
She pauses again as if to do the math.
But even now, after an immense journey in separate directions, that tree and you still share a quarter of your genes.
In this manner, tacking into the breeze of the author's thought, they make their way through 4 full pages before the light starts to fail. They eat again by candlelight, instant soup mix floating on 2 cups of water warmed on the tiny camp stove. By the time they're done, darkness rules. The logger's engines have stopped, replaced by the 1,000 spectral challenges of night that they cannot decode.
We should save the candle, she says.
We should. It's hours before bedtime. They lie on the long, rocking platform of their pledge, chattering to each other in the dark. Up here, they face no dangers but the oldest one. When the wind blows, it feels like they're crossing the Pacific on a makeshift raft. When the wind stops, the stillness suspends them between 2 eternities, entirely in the caress of here and now. In the dark, she asks,
"What are you thinking?"
He's thinking that his life has reached its zenith this very day, that he has lived to see everything he wants, lived to see himself happy. "I was thinking it's going to be cold again tonight. We may need to zip the bags together."
"I'm down with that."
Every star in the galaxy rolls out above them, through the blue-black needles, in a river of spilled milk. The night sky, the best drug there was, before people came together into something stronger. They zip the bags together.
"You know," she says, "if one of us falls, the other is going with."
"I'll follow you anywhere." They wake before it's fully light to the sound of engines in the deep beneath them.